Some sunshine for the north and west of Scotland and Northern Ireland, but a chilly start here. Southern and eastern Scotland will start mostly cloudy with some outbreaks of rain and remaining cloudy and grey through the day. But Northern Ireland, the western half of Scotland, will be bright through the day with a few showers around, but cool, highs between 13 and 17 degrees. Friday night, very wet and windy across Northern England, North Wales and also for Scotland with some heavy rain in places. And then into the weekend, low pressure dominating, sunshine and showers, feeling cool too.
Thank you, Stav. Now on BBC Radio 4, our Book of the Week. A fortnight after invading and burning Washington, the British Army turns on Baltimore, but the delay proves deadly. Jamie Parker continues reading Peter Snow's book, When Britain Burned the White House, and the date is Sunday, the 28th of August, 1814.
2 days after the British forces had left the nation's capital, President James Madison wrote a letter to his wife Dolly at her country retreat.
My dearest, I have just read a line from Colonel Monroe saying that the enemy were out of Washington and on the retreat to their ships. We shall accordingly set out thither immediately. You will, of course, take the same resolution.
Madison told his wife he didn't know where they would hide their heads in the city once they arrived, but he'd sought something out. Their close friend, Margaret Bayard Smith, and her family also ventured back into the city, where she found the shell of the White House still smoking. When Dolly Madison finally arrived back in Washington, she was met that evening by Mrs. Smith, who wrote in her diary,
"Although Dolly seemed much depressed and could scarcely speak without tears, she was very violent against the English, and wished we had 10,000 men to sink our enemy to the bottomless pit."
General Ross, Admiral Coburn, and their victorious soldiers and sailors took 4 days to return to their ships moored in the Patuxent River. The Americans allowed the British Army to retire without any interference. Their sharpshooters and cavalry skirmishes could have caused the British no end of trouble, but they were glad enough to see them go without provoking further fighting. General Ross could not conceal his pride about the successful Washington campaign in a letter to his sister-in-law, Maria Souter.
"Our little operation here will no doubt appear brilliant, and so, not to speak too partially of our own feats, it ought."
There was only one curious exception to the Americans' failure to molest Ross's withdrawal. A seemingly minor incident at the time, it led to one of America's proudest moments, the unfurling of the Star-Spangled Banner over a fort in Baltimore, which inspired the U.S. national anthem. It began during the British retreat with the arrest of Dr. William Beanes. Beanes was a respected local doctor in Upper Marlborough who had made a point of being gracious and hospitable to Robert Ross on his way through the town a week earlier. The doctor and two friends now heard that some British stragglers had stayed on in the town and were now bent on robbery and looting. The elderly doctor briskly set about rounding up three of the stragglers and locking them up, but one of them managed to escape. He dashed off, rejoined the British army, and reported the arrest of his mates. That night, a troop of mounted British soldiers raced back to Upper Marlborough, released the detained stragglers, and forced William Beanes to ride the 35 miles to Benedict, where he was kept in detention. He was treated not as a prisoner of war, but as a civilian who had won the respect of the British commanders a week earlier, but had now betrayed that trust. A young Washington lawyer, Francis Scott Key, knew William Beanes, and when he heard that the old doctor had been captured, he asked President Madison to give his sanction for a special mission to the British. Key would go together with the official prisoner exchange commissioner, John Skinner. Madison agreed, and the two men sailed off in a small vessel under a flag of truce to rendezvous with General Ross at the mouth of the Potomac. They persuaded Ross to relent, and he agreed that Dr. Beanes should be set free. But for the moment, Key and Skinner were not permitted to leave the ship. They had seen and heard too much to be allowed to go home. While the British fleet remained at anchor in Chesapeake Bay, Sir Alexander Cochrane and his commanders continued their debate about what to do next. Ross was against an attack on the city of Baltimore. In a letter to his wife Elizabeth, Ross wrote,
"I trust that our differences with the Yankees will shortly be settled. That wish is, I believe, very prevalent with them. The injury sustained by the city of Washington and the destruction of its public buildings has been immense, and must disgust the country with a government that has left the capital unprotected.
Ross was right about the immediate effect on Madison's government, but his burning of the new nation's proudest monuments was, in a matter of days, to put new heart into Americans and determination never to let such a thing happen again. The moment the people of Baltimore saw their southern night sky lit up by the flames of Washington, they were convinced that it was their turn next. David Winchester wrote from Baltimore to his brother,
"You may be sure this is the most awful moment of my life. Not because if the place is defended I shall put my life at hazard, in common with my fellow citizens, but because I am positively sure we shall not succeed."
But Baltimore was not Washington. Maryland's big city was a thriving commercial metropolis, passionately proud of its prosperity and blessed with a citizenry that had had the foresight to make some serious provisions for its defense. Baltimore stood at the head of another river that flowed into Chesapeake Bay, the Patapsco. The river's northwest branch made a fine natural harbor protected by Fort McHenry, Baltimore's great defensive bastion. It was built in the shape of a star, and its walls and ramparts presented hardly any exposed vertical face to direct cannon fire. In the late 1790s, Sam Smith, a tough-spoken Maryland congressman, had been a powerful advocate of the fort's modernization. 35 years later, when war broke out with Britain, Smith was now a U.S. senator and major general commanding Baltimore's militia. So when Maryland's governor looked around for a prestigious commander to superintend the city's defenses in case of a British attack, General Smith was the natural choice. After the British marched into a largely undefended Washington, Smith threw all his energy into ensuring that Baltimore would learn the lessons. The all-powerful Committee of Vigilance and Safety sent out the order.
The owners of slaves are requested to send them to work.
Few failed to rally to the call. Earthworks were constructed, reinforcements summoned from other states, weapons of all types procured, and forward medical posts established. While older men stuffed cartridges with powder, women could wrap bandages. In the words of one volunteer,
"Every heart was bursting with shame. The horrible mismanagement at Washington has taught us a useful lesson, and we must be worse than stupid if we do not make proper use of it."
General Smith and his fast-growing army could hardly believe their luck in having more than 2 weeks to build up their strength before the British arrived. Cochrane's dithering allowed Smith to muster a force of up to 15,000 men. Many of them were new to the ranks, and they came from all walks of life. Edgar Allan Poe's 71-year-old grandfather was there. George Douglas was a merchant with the rank of private on the eastern heights of Hampstead Hill, from where he could see the fortifications.
"An extensive and beautiful prospect of a multitude of tents, baggage, and cannon in every direction. At least a mile of entrenchments with suitable batteries were raised as if by magic."
Then, at noon, on Sunday the 11th of September, 1814, the gun on Federal Hill overlooking Baltimore Harbor sounded the alarm. The bells of Christ's Church, cast in a foundry in Britain, clanged out their warning that the British enemy were at hand. Cochrane's fleet was anchoring off North Point, just 13 miles down the road. The army that had burned the White House was preparing to land and march on Baltimore. George Coburn relished the prospect of a new battle as the fleet came to anchor off North Point, but he was exasperated by the loss of momentum. He guessed, rightly, that the people of Baltimore had used every moment of the past 2 weeks to bolster their defenses. The young subaltern George Glegg had been scanning the Maryland coast with mounting excitement as the fleet drew nearer to North Point. It sailed past a number of watchtowers and signal stations, and as the warships approached each of them, horsemen would leap into the saddle and gallop off.
Beacon after beacon burst into a blaze. Guns were fired from every tower, and telegraphic communication carried on without intermission.
Glegg watched as panic-stricken villagers abandoned their homes with their belongings strapped on wagons. By 3 a.m. on the 12th of September, the moon had gone, and the night was pitch dark. In total silence, the men climbed down into small boats and rowed ashore. Every precaution was taken in case the landing was opposed, but as the day dawned, it became clear that there were no enemy guarding the shoreline. By 7 o'clock, the entire army was ready to march off. Rear Admiral Edward Codrington, still aboard, wrote to his wife,
"The work of destruction is now about to begin, and there will probably be many broken heads tonight."
In Baltimore, General Sam Smith summoned his commanders and revealed his plan to defend the city. He would keep his main force back behind the fortifications they'd erected over the previous 3 weeks on the city's fringe. He would send forward his most trusty commander, Brigadier General John Stricker, with just over 3,000 of his best trained men. Meanwhile, Ross's army tramped on towards Baltimore through quite dense woodland on the North Point Peninsula. On the way, George Glegg and his light infantrymen captured 3 American cavalrymen who were young volunteers and took the men to meet Ross and Coburn. The 3 prisoners left Ross in no doubt that the city was well defended by several batteries of guns and by a force of some 20,000 men, 5 times the size of Ross's force. But the general showed no sign of hesitation. When someone observed that most of the American defenders were militia, he is said to have been dismissive of them.
"I don't care if it rains, militia."
Robert Ross was now all confidence and bravado, and that recklessness led him to take a risk that would change the course of the campaign. As his troops advanced on Baltimore, Ross himself was never far behind the men at the very front of his army. Soon, they ran into territory where the Americans for the first time mounted a dangerous threat. Not satisfied with the speed of the advance, Ross chose to ride right forward to see for himself what the opposition amounted to. George Glegg wrote,
"How bitterly had the whole expedition cause to lament that step."
Ross took one good look at the ground ahead and was turning to George Coburn, who typically had accompanied him to the front line, when a shot rang out. Glegg says,
"An American rifleman singled him out. He fired, and the ball, true to its mark, pierced his side. I chanced to be standing at no great distance from him. I saw that he was struck, for the reins dropped instantly from his hand, and he leaned forward upon the pommel of his saddle."
Admiral Coburn watched as Ross's aides raced to carry him back towards the ships, but Ross died before they reached the shore. A small rowing boat carried his body back to the fleet, wrapped in the Union Jack. Ross was a huge loss to the British Army in America at this particular moment. The man who now suddenly found himself propelled into command was Colonel Arthur Brooke. He was a veteran 42-year-old battalion commander who had led his 44th Regiment through many a Mediterranean battle with the French, but he was never to enjoy the depth of respect and affection that Robert Ross did. According to George Glegg,
"He is an officer of decided personal courage, but perhaps better suited to lead a battalion than to guide an army."
Brooke had no time to be troubled by any self-doubt. The moment he heard Ross was wounded, he spurred his horse to the front. Within an hour of taking command, Brooke faced what looked like the opportunity of a lifetime. If he could scatter these Americans as decisively as Robert Ross had at Bladensburg, the city of Baltimore would surely be at his mercy.
When Britain Burns the White House is written by Peter Snow and read by Jamie Parker. It's a heavy entertainment production for BBC Radio 4, and it concludes tomorrow. And now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Friday the 6th of September. There is a warning of gales in Irish Sea. The general synopsis at 1800, low, southeast England, 1007, expected 40s with little change by 1800 Friday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking, southeasterly at first, in east, otherwise northwesterly, veering northeasterly, 5 or 6, occasionally 7 in south. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor in east. North Utsira, South Utsira, southeasterly 5 to 7, backing northeasterly 5 or 6 in North Utsira. Rain or showers, good, occasionally poor. East 40s, cyclonic 4 or 5, increasing 5 to 7. Rain or showers, fog patches, moderate, occasionally very poor. West 40s, Cromarty 4.